Yousaf was certain that the Americans had recruited spies in his own intelligence service. Many of his men trained in the United States, and he wondered what kind of bribes they'd been offered. His sense of the CIA's power was no doubt so exaggerated as to be detached from reality, but it was a perception shared by many of his countrymen. He was quite convinced that the Americans hated and feared his religion, and that the agency was helping Pakistan only because of its Cold War with the communists. He was sure that the same CIA spies helping him with the Mujahideen were at the same time trying to halt his country's efforts to build an Islamic bomb. He knew that they feared such Afghan fundamentalists as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, his favorite commander, whom the ISI had had on its payroll for more than a decade. The fundamentalist Mujahideen were the ones he and his intelligence chief had always favored, and he was offended when the U.S. Embassy and the press corps called on the ISI to cut off these true warriors of Allah and turn the jihad over to the washed-out Muslims. This he refused to do. It was an awesome responsibility that had been placed on his shoulders, and in the 1,407th year of the Islamic calendar, Brigadier Yousaf considered it a unique privilege as a Pakistan Army officer to stand astride this greatest of all modern jihads. So he went to sleep on November 15th, filled with pride, a man who bowed only to Allah. In truth, his loyalties ran almost as deeply to his Imperial ISI chief, General Akhtar Abdul Rahman, who woke him up in the middle of that night with an urgent directive from the president himself, General Zia-ul-Haq. "An American official with a woman is trying to enter Afghanistan from Pakistan," Akhtar said. "The brigadier must locate this man and stop him. It was of the utmost importance." Akhtar sternly added a proviso: "Yousaf must not reveal that the ISI or the Pakistani government was involved." The American official headed for Afghanistan was, of course, Charlie Wilson, but Zia had it wrong about the woman's destination. Sweetums had no intention of going into the war zone. It was not her idea of a good time. In fact, she was quite put out about having to sit around Peshawar while her man went off on his rite of passage. But Wilson had sweet-talked her into another one of those junkets that she would never forget, and Annalisa had somehow allowed her hopes to rise again. Though the incident with the DIA plane was still fresh in his mind, Wilson was truly pushing the envelope with this latest junket. He envisioned the trip as the ultimate romantic vacation: the Amalfi Coast, the baby elephant orphanage in Sri Lanka, the shopping wonders of Hong Kong, the exotic teeming streets of Shanghai, and the Great Wall of China, all of this leading up to Sweetums's lifelong fantasy, a week in Tahiti. The month-long trip began in Rome, where Bertie van Storer, the Oerlikon representative, would entertain them. There was a stopover in London, and then on to Pakistan for a closer look at the war. He had arranged for his favorite Pentagon traveling aide, Colonel Rooney, to come along to handle logistics, including him even in the non-business-related legs of the trip that Wilson was paying for out of his own pocket. It was not only pleasant having the personable colonel along to share the sights, it was necessary in order to justify having the main portions of the junket picked up by defense appropriations. When they reached Pakistan, Sweetums was perplexed to learn that Charlie intended to leave her alone in the hotel while he disappeared into Afghanistan. He explained that he had developed a deep need to experience combat with the Mujahideen. Given Charlie's relationship to the program, you might think he would have tried to keep this CIA covert operation a secret. But he was now becoming just a bit flaky, and he had brought along a Texas reporter to chronicle his trip into the war zone. He was offering the young man the experience of his life, but the morning before they were scheduled to go in, they went to the Khyber Pass, where the journalist looked down with horror at the sight of a Red Army tank brigade in ferocious action. Wilson experienced some butterflies himself, but the reporter had a wife and two children at home. He didn't want to be a war correspondent. Ever the gentleman, Charlie gracefully let him bow out. Actually, it only made him feel all the more heroic when he embraced Sweetums in his Afghan robes and strode out onto the street to meet the Mujahideen who had come to take him off to fight the Russians. She said she would be waiting for him at the American consulate when he returned. In a four-wheel drive surrounded by bearded Afghans carrying AK-47s with an extra one set aside for him, Charlie felt that he had now crossed the Rubicon. He had, however, made one major mistake. Over dinner the night before in Islamabad, he had told Zia of his plans. The Pakistani president, famous for his perpetual smile, had kept his poker face. He had even told Charlie that he envied him. Inshallah, God willing, they would meet soon to discuss Wilson's great adventure. But even as Wilson was passing through the gate of Zia's residence, the president who ruled his country by martial law had ordered his intelligence chief, General Akhtar, to stop Wilson. They couldn't afford to lose this man. He was too important to Pakistan. This was not the kind of mission Brigadier Yusuf relished, but he set off for Peshawar at 4:30 in the morning, and by 6:30 he had mobilized all of the ISI assets throughout the frontier city. Yusuf had spies everywhere in Peshawar. The ISI had bugged Dean's Hotel, where Crandall had held his cross-border meetings. They had waiters, hotel managers, and telephone operators throughout the city. Most important, the ISI had eyes and ears everywhere in the vast Afghan population, particularly in the headquarters and in compounds where the commanders and leaders of the different political parties lived with their armed followers. It was only a matter of hours before Yusuf's men spotted a tall foreigner entering Abdul Haq's walled compound. Haq was the natural choice for Wilson's guide to the jihad. He was probably the U.S. reporter's favorite mujahideen commander, a brave young fundamentalist with enormous charm. Yusuf controlled Haq's right to be in Peshawar, not to mention his access to CIA weapons. Nevertheless, Haq refused to consider his directive. The Afghan said he had no choice but to take the congressman in, no matter what Zia or the brigadier or anyone else said. Yusuf had just run head-on into the Pashtun's ancient code of honor, hospitality, and revenge. Haq explained that he had already given his word. Wilson was now under his protection, and by his code he must fulfill his commitment to take the American into the war zone and return him safely. So, in spite of Brigadier Yusuf and the iron control of the ISI, later that day the congressman was speeding through the tribal zone in Hawk's four-wheel drive, one of those vehicles that Larry Crandall's cross-border program had given to the commander to spread goodwill. Dressed like a holy warrior, Wilson was preparing himself emotionally for whatever they might run into, when a jeep coming from the border signaled them to pull over. The driver reported heavy fighting between two tribes up ahead. Wilson's driver got a very worried look on his long Afghan face when a Pakistani tribal guard ran up to them with news that the entire road was caught up in the fighting. With the sound of intense gunfire and explosions close by, the driver turned the vehicle around and headed back to Peshawar. Apologizing profusely, he explained that his orders had been to take Wilson into Afghanistan, to protect him there and to bring him back safely. He would not be forgiven if he led Commander Hawk's guest to his death before they had even crossed the border. It didn't take Wilson long to figure out what had happened, and by the time he burst into the Peshawar house of Kurt Lobeck, the CBS stringer who had introduced him to Abdul Haq, Wilson was beside himself with rage. He knew he had been taken. Lobeck listened with amazement as the congressman got General Akhtar on the phone and lit into the intelligence chief. "It's my war, goddammit. I'm paying for it, and I'm damn well going to see it." Under normal circumstances, Akhtar did not take well to outsiders lecturing him. In his shadowy ISI empire, his word was law. But Akhtar had absolutely no interest in provoking Wilson's fury, nor did Foreign Minister Yaqub Khan, who remembers this confrontation as a matter of the gravest national concern. "We had to ask, what if he were killed on such a trip? For Charlie, it was a romantic adventure. For us, it was a horrible position without any possible benefit." Ultimately, it was Zia's dilemma, so the call was passed on to him. Zia had many reasons for not wanting Charlie to go into Afghanistan, not the least of which was that it violated his strict rule against any U.S. government officials entering the war from his country. He did not even acknowledge that Pakistan was helping the Mujahideen, much less that it was working with the CIA, and here Wilson had been planning to take a reporter in with him. But the real reason went far deeper than that, and Zia could not spell it out. Pakistan was then facing a historic threat to its own survival, and, strange as it may seem, Zia saw Charlie Wilson as an indispensable part of the country's national defense. That year, India had mobilized again, and Zia and his staff had been forced to contemplate Pakistan's chances if war should break out. The picture was incredibly grim. For one thing, India had the bomb. It had exploded a nuclear device back in 1974, and no one doubted that it had the ability to wipe out Pakistan. Beyond that, India's huge army had already defeated Pakistan in three wars. To add to Zia's paranoia, he considered India a virtual client state of the Soviet Union. With Hinds now being shot out of the sky by ISI-delivered Stingers and Black Tulips flying even more dead soldiers back to Russia, no one needed to point out to Zia that this was a moment when Moscow might well encourage India to go for broke.